This Janet Mufford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org.
This is Janet Mufford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mufford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, as we told you recently, the state of Alabama is well on its way toward eliminating marriage licenses. The Alabama Senate recently passed a measure setting up a process under which probate judges accept affidavits from couples as official records of marriage. And as AL.com reported, the requirement of a ceremony to solemnize the marriage would also be eliminated. Now, the sponsor, Senator Greg Allbritton, said this will take the state out of any role in marriage ceremonies and properly separate church and state. Also, solving the problem of probate judges who don't want to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. But could there be unintended consequences? My next guest has written about this idea that taking the state out of the marriage business will lead to a better future for everyone. So we're going to get some thoughts on this now from Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, who is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. And Jennifer, just wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Janice. This is quite a thing, isn't it? Alabama getting out of the marriage business.
I know exactly what you've said. And by the way, I should tell people, you wrote a three-part series on the public discourse back in 2012, which people really need to read in detail because you really get this issue. What is your reaction to this? Does this alarm you, or does it seem like maybe it's an okay compromise? How do you interpret it?
Well, first of all, people want to find that three-part series that I did. We sell it at the Ruth Institute now, so people could go to ruthinstitute.org and go to our store, and we call it the government's duty to marriage.
Great.
Okay, the government has a duty to marriage, and that duty is to say that these two people are the parents of this child, and nobody else is. You know, that's the long and short of it, that the institution of marriage is something that should be there for the state to do justice to children and parents.
Yes.
That's what it should be all about. And so this thing that Alabama has done, you know, Janet, I can't quite figure it out because I can't figure out what it's going to mean for the definition of parenthood.
Yeah.
You see, that has always been my concern with this issue. I don't really care that much about licenses and, you know, and ceremonies and stuff per se. That's not my concern. My concern is that marriage has been traditionally the thing that connects children to their parents so that everybody can know this man, this woman, they are the parents of this child. I have no idea what this is going to mean for the establishment of parental rights. I haven't seen anybody say what they think it's going to mean. So I don't know. Have you seen anything about this?
No,
that story you sent me, that's it.
That's why we called you. Because I said, if anybody's going to know, Jennifer Roback-Morse is going to know. I had the exact same reaction, though. It's so funny that you said that, because I read that and I was talking to some friends of mine who are very much on the LGBT issues. And I said, this has a possibility of going the wrong direction when I've heard all these gay activists over the years saying the state should just get out of the marriage business. We want to just get rid of marriage. And I thought there's got to be some connection here. But when you read the story, this state senator says, well, this is a way to separate church and state and not have to violate the consciences of these probate judges. But I do wonder what sort of unintended consequences might come of it.
Yes, you know, he sounds like, and I have heard this argument from religious people before, you know, saying that this is the way to, you know, leave it to the church. You know, that a person's going to be validly married if their church says they're validly married. Well, that's not really much of an answer when there are legal implications of marriage. I forget the exact word, but there are legal implications for marriage that have to do with property, that have to do with custody if there's a separation and you're trying to figure out who's going to be in charge of the children and that kind of thing. You know, so the state is never going to leave the church alone to do whatever the church thinks is the right thing to do about marriage. You know, so that idea, you know, if that's your idea that, you know, okay, you know, now marriage is all belongs to the church now, and we just have this funny little probate procedure, and that's the whole involvement of the state, that's very naive. You know, if that's what they think they're doing, that's very naive, because if the relationship breaks down, what do we even call it? It's not a marriage. right? If the couple decides they don't want to be together anymore, you can be sure that they're not just going to go down to their pastor and whatever Pastor Joe says, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, that's not how it's going to go. You know,
no.
The court's going to get involved. Family court's going to be involved. There might be DNA testing to figure out if the guy's really the father. You know, the state will not leave this alone completely. And,
no.
And that, if that's the hope, that I think that's a naive hope.
No, I agree. And one of the things that you've said is that marriage is society's primary institutional arrangement that defines parenthood. And so marriage has a social public function. In other words, you can't ultimately privatize marriage, can you?
That's exactly right. You know, so they're going to rename that function. Let's see. I mean, that's really, in a sense, what they're doing is they're renaming that function. But if I could use this $10 word here, they're deinstitutionalizing that function.
Yeah.
So instead of there being, you know, just a few kind of bright line rules that say these are the parents of the child, now you're going to be doing case by case stuff. You know, so the traditional method, just to review, the traditional method was when a baby is born, the woman who gives birth to the baby is presumed to be the child's mother.
Yes.
Right. That used to be 100% bulletproof, brain dead conception. But now that we have surrogacy, it isn't anymore. But set aside surrogacy for a moment. When the woman gives birth to the baby, she's legally presumed to be the child's mother. And then the question is, who's the father? Well, if the woman is married, when you have an establishment or an institution that says, we have a lifelong union of a man and a woman and a sexually exclusive union of a man and a woman, then you presume that her husband is the father of any children she gives birth to.
Right.
And that's the way the law worked. That was called the presumption of paternity, and it had the effect of attaching children to their biological parents and, incidentally, excluding every other possible person from having a legal claim to be the child's parent, which is a good thing, right?
Yes. Yes.
attaching children to their parents and minimizing headaches and uncertainty and quarrels and that kind of thing. So now, if you don't have an institution like that, how are you going to know who's the father? How are you going to know who has legal responsibility for that child? And I suppose what you're going to have to do is to say the woman is going to name the guy on the birth certificate, which that already, in the case of unmarried parenthood, that already is how it's done, I think. She names the guy. Well, maybe he's not around. Maybe he doesn't want to be named. Maybe he thinks it isn't really his kid, you know?
Yeah.
So then there has to be a backup plan, which is you go do a paternity test and you find out if it really is him. So by taking away that legal structure of marriage, you're not going to solve the problem of who counts as the child parent. You're going to have to solve that problem some other way.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And if the father is a guy who is, for whatever reason, not particularly committed to this woman, he's not going to just voluntarily pay a child support just out of the goodness of his heart. He's going to have to be compelled.
Yeah.
You know, the state's going to have to be involved in making him pay and extracting resources and all that kind of thing. And you didn't have to do that in a marriage. In a marriage, the husband and wife, mother and father, have already agreed
Yes.
that they're going to live together and share resources and build a home together and build a life together. And yes, there are sometimes problems, but those problems are nothing compared with the kind of problems that we're setting ourselves up for under this type of arrangement. So that's what I would say is the concern. That's my concern. And I haven't seen anybody in Alabama explain how they're going to solve that.
I know.
So, I don't know, Janet.
I don't know either. I don't know how it's going to come down, but I just keep looking at it and saying this. I just don't think this is going to end well, especially if this becomes a new thing. And that's always the concern, that once one state goes in that direction, other states say, oh, this will solve our problem. And I'm not convinced that it will.
No, I'm convinced that it won't solve the problem. I mean, it's going to cascade into other areas that I don't think people have thought through yet. That's really the issue, you know, that the first time somebody comes into court with a dispute or a question, then they'll have to answer this question.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, hang on just a moment. We're going to go to a quick break. We'll come back with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse from the Ruth Institute talking about privatizing marriage. Stay with us. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is Ann's story.
I had numerous credit cards and I was struggling with paying them off. I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. They took care of all of my credit cards and now I am completely debt free. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place. My name is Ann, and thanks to Trinity, I'm debt free for keeps.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her. And she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, for her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229. Or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Thank you for joining us. My guest, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. And you can check out at ruthinstitute.org, The Government's Duty to Marriage. You really have to read what Jennifer has written on this subject of privatizing marriage and why it's not a good idea. And the news story that is triggering all of this is the state of Alabama, the Senate at least, has passed this measure setting up a process where they are eliminating marriage licenses. And this is supposed to solve the problem of probate judges who don't want to issue licenses to same-sex couples. But could there be unintended consequences? My question to Jennifer is, if you get out the state out of the business of issuing marriage licenses, how can you continue to define marriage? I mean, is there any problem there where they'll begin to lose more in the way of saying you can do this but not that? Or would that accelerate the slippery slope?
Well, I think they believe that by not issuing marriage licenses, that's what they've done, that they're becoming neutral with respect to different types of relationships. I think that's what they are attempting to do here. And so I'm guessing that what's going to happen as a practical matter is that whatever procedures they have in place now for children of unmarried parents, those procedures, whether you call that a common law marriage or common law union or whatever, whatever those procedures are, I'm guessing that's what's going to be applied to everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the question is there any problem with that? Well, my only point about that, first point is, so all the problems you were worried about reappear in that new forum, right? So if the person is not the child's biological other parent, but you don't want to have a relationship with the child's other biological parent, You still have to make some decisions about who you're going to count as the legal parent of the child.
Right.
And you are going to privilege, so-called privilege, use that term privilege, you are going to privilege some relationships over others because the state is going to say, yes, this person counts as a parent, no, that person doesn't count. You know, so they're going to end up making some kind of judgments, you know, and the LGBT advocates do not want biology.
No.
To be the sole determinant of parenthood or even the main determinant of parenthood. I mean, if you read some of the radicals, Janet, they think biology is way, way overrated.
Yes.
You know, and so they want to break down the connection in people's mind between biology and legal parenthood. So is this going to help that? Is this going to hurt that? This particular thing that the state of Alabama is doing, they're still going to have to deal with it. That's my point. They're still going to have to answer that question. What does the state of Alabama think about parentage.
Yeah.
Who counts as a parent in the state of Alabama? They're still going to have to answer that question. And they're not going to say anybody who shows up and says they're a parent gets to be a parent.
No.
That's not going to be the rule.
Right.
That's not going to be the rule, I guarantee you, you know.
Yeah, you're so right about it. But one of the things that happens, and this is going back to something you said before the break, when you say that the state, in the attempt to privatize marriage, ends up getting more power, actually, on the other end. Mm-hmm. One of the things you cite is no-fault divorce. So they thought at the time, you get rid of, you know, these standards for getting a divorce. We're going to allow people to get divorced for any reason. And that'll simplify things and that'll make us more neutral. It actually made things worse on the back end. Can you explain what that's about, why that is?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, what happened with divorce is that, to use the language you just used there, you're more free on the front end when you enter into divorce, but you're way less free on the back end because the state ends up coming back into the process. They say, oh, you can get divorced for any reason you want. But the fact is that most divorces do not take place by the mutual agreement of the parties. That's a complete myth. Probably at least 70% of divorces take place against the wishes of one party.
Wow.
So that means if you're going to have so-called no-fault divorce, it's really unilateral divorce. The government has to enforce that divorce. They have to separate somebody from the assets of the family, usually the family home and the children, right? The state has to enforce that. That person doesn't want to move out. They don't want to give up seeing their kids.
Yeah.
But the government is involved in that. And they become involved. They can become involved. And your listeners will recognize this, I'm sure. The government can end up being involved in literally every aspect of the family's life.
Yeah.
You know, they're telling you how much money you have to spend, how much money the non-custodial parent, usually the father, has to send to the custodial parent. They'll be adjudicating who gets to see the child and when, at what time, for how long, and things that used to be done through mutual cooperation and through love, or that could be done through love and mutual cooperation, those things are now being done by court decree.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, I tell people this who are thinking about getting divorced, so I would just put this thought in your mind. If you think he's mean now, what do you think he's going to be like after you've put him through family court?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Is he going to be easier to deal with after that? But I mean, that takes us a little bit further afield from what we're trying to talk about here. But
it's true,
but it shows that the state, by saying you can get divorced for any reason you want, you're completely free to do whatever you want, that's a myth.
Yeah.
That's a complete myth.
Yeah.
And it's going to show up in this instance by saying, well, anybody can have any relationship they want. The government will not take sides or choose among different types of relationship. That sounds so freeing and so wonderful and so modern and hip and everything. But when it comes down to it, if you've got children, somebody has to decide who's responsible for those children.
That's it.
And you will not always get what you want. I guarantee you, you're not always going to get what you want. And for sure, the kids are not always going to get what they need. That's for sure.
Yes.
So that's the trade-off. That's the big trade-off. And people just aren't even aware that they're setting themselves up for that trade-off.
It makes total sense. The other thing that strikes me is the more that the family breaks apart, the more power the state gets. But then that should show the state why it's important to protect the family to begin with, because it's resulted in all of this chaos. I mean, you mentioned that you even have parenthood becoming the creation of the state. Now that you've got the octomoms of the world and you've got the welfare state,
right,
and the state is the de facto
right
husband who isn't around to take care of the kids. Isn't this more of a reason for the state to say, yes, we should be involved in the business of marriage, and it's between a man and a woman? Let's go back to plan A, because plan B is just ensuing in all this chaos.
Well, that depends on what the people in the government actually are trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
If they want more power for themselves, this is a great plan.
True. Oh.
Social chaos is a great plan if you're trying to maximize your power, if you're trying to come up with more reasons why the government needs more money for this program or the other program. And if you're not really happy with how these parents are taking care of their own kids, and maybe they're indoctrinating them into strange things, and maybe the government just really needs to be involved in rearing everybody's kids.
Yeah.
You know, hey, some of the people, Janet, totalitarians of every stripe, that they always want to get a grip on the family.
They do.
The family is always in their way, you know? So, I mean, I'm not accusing anybody directly, but from one perspective, it's not that surprising that the government doesn't really mind some of the social chaos that the breakdown of the family has caused.
Yeah, it's a great point. Next thing you know will be Canada, though. I mean, look what's going on in Canada with the family. Oh, we don't want to let Christian parents adopt. I mean, it's getting insane, but nothing is going to stop it from eventually coming here if the ideology is all messed up.
No, that's right, Janet. I mean, what I think is that the typical Christian person has no idea just how toxic these ideologies really are.
True.
A lot of people thought, well, gee, feminism sounds so nice. You know, we should be fair to women. We shouldn't let women do whatever job they want and get paid the same as men. That's only fair. But that isn't really what it was all about. You know, there were that was kind of the smoke screen. That was the thing that was put out front for people to look at. Behind it was the idea, we're going to make everybody equal in every way. Mm. Well, you can't really do that unless you can control everything they do.
Right.
You know, that's the little hidden message that people hope nobody looks at too closely. But the fact is, if you're going to try to make everybody be equal in every way, that means you get to control everything in every way.
That's true.
And we've let way too much go by because things sound good and we're not looking behind the slogans to see what is really going to happen.
Yes, and I don't understand when Alabama eliminates marriage licenses, it seems to me that you don't even have to go that far. If you want to protect the consciences of the probate judges, just pass a religious freedom law like they did in Mississippi and say you don't have to issue a license if it's against your conscience. I mean, whatever happened to the First Amendment here? It's as if the First Amendment doesn't have any weight, and it ought to have tremendous weight in these cases.
Well, you know what? I don't want to hurt your feelings. I don't want to hurt Kim Davis's feelings or anything. But to me, I'm not that worried about religious freedom, Janet. Mm. I'm worried about the fact that the religious people are correct on the substance of the issue.
True.
And if the only thing we worry about is you're making me do something against my conscience, we're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
Because we need to make a full-throated defense of why we're right and why these innovations are wrong.
You know, well said.
Why they're going to hurt people, see?
I agree.
And so that's why, you know, yeah, we need religious liberty, but if that's all we have to say, I think in the end we won't win that. We need to be saying on the substance of the issue, children need their parents, therefore we need to have some rigorous institution that defends the right of children to their parents. And here's why, you know, and that's what we need to be talking about. And what makes me kind of sad about about what I've read in the Alabama case so far, what makes me sad about it is that I don't see anybody over there talking like this.
No,
you know,
I know.
People. I mean, people give lip service to kids need a mom and a dad. You know, that's lame. Kids need their own mom.
Thank you.
And their own dad.
Yes, exactly. their mom and their dad who created them. Absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
What
right.
a concept.
Right. We've let so much go by. The whole divorce culture has already undermined that so much that it's hard for people to say and really have their hearts in it, you know.
I know. Well, Jennifer Roback Morris, check out RuthInstitute.org. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. We are are back on Janet Mefford Today. So how in the world did a thrice married billionaire with no experience in elected office win the presidency in 2016? While the leftist media still doesn't understand it, neither does Hollywood, nor do the safe space academicians or even progressives inside evangelicalism. That's why we've seen endless pieces on how evangelicals sold their souls to the devil when they voted for Trump. And it's why we see the resistance movement always on the march, always trying to unseat Donald Trump from the Oval Office. But what is really going on? According to my next guest, the truth about Trump's victory actually has to do with the emergence of a new conservative nationalist age. So we're going to find out more about it now from speaker and author Dr. Steve Turley, faculty member at Tall Oaks Classical School in Newcastle, Delaware, where he teaches theology, Greek, and rhetoric, and also professor of fine arts at Eastern University. And he's here to talk about his latest book. It's called President Trump and Our Post-Secular Future, How the 2016 Election Signals the Dawning of a Conservative Nationalist Age. Great title and great to have you here, Dr. Turley. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Janet. It's great to be back with you. It's been too long.
It sure has. I just think it's terrific that you're here. And this seems to be the ongoing question for many Americans. They still can't figure it out. How in the world did Donald Trump win? What's your take?
Yeah, it's a perfect setup there because I wrote the book because I felt that the significance of the 2016 election really hasn't been fully appreciated, again, just like you said, either by liberals or by conservatives. It's really a commonplace belief that Trump won on a fluke, and the fluke was Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So it's an assertion that basically says Hillary was a fatally flawed candidate. And if the Democrats, I've actually personally heard this, if the Democrats ran anybody else, particularly Bernie, that they would have won. But what I believe this assumption misses is that Donald Trump's presidential victory was not a fluke. It's actually a symbol of much larger processes that are going on all over the world. And I don't think we can really understand the 2016 election if we overlook these processes and how they factored into President Trump's victory.
Yeah, well, unpack some of that. Let's hear some of the reasons. When you look at things like Brexit, for example, people have drawn parallels between the United States election last year and also, I guess, 2 years ago now, 2016, and what's been going on over in Europe, and those who say we want to leave the EU, maybe some other European nations will do the same thing the UK did. How do you put this all together?
What I basically identify are three characteristics that have developed in response to something called globalization. I'm sure many in your audience are familiar with the term. And scholars generally define globalization as this mass economic political system made up of transnational corporations and interlocking government structures that fundamentally redefine the borders, economy, and culture of a nation. It's a thoroughly secularized conception of social order. And it ends up having actually a lot of flaws within it. So, for example, globalization negates borders through its transnational flow of goods and its mass immigration, both legal and illegal. It tends to negate local industry by shipping manufacturing the industry overseas, as it were, in a global division of labor where industries relocated to the global south and finance is centered in the global north, and particularly in urban areas like New York and LA. And globalization negates culture by eclipsing localized customs and traditional ways of life with transnational narcissistic consumerism. Mm-hmm. And so in the face of national economic and cultural threats, we're finding that populations tend to reassert their traditional identity markers. They tend to, as it were, cling to their guns and religion, as one highly prominent secularist once complained.
Yes.
As mechanisms of resistance against these anti-cultural processes of globalization and its secular aristocracy. And it's this blowback, this threefold blowback, that's sort of the fundamental force or dynamic, I think, that's propelling us into a nationalist age, a nationalist conservative age, and what I particularly call a post-secular age.
Yeah. Now, this is all such fascinating stuff because I think you're right on the money about this. And this is something Trump obviously latched onto when he talked about immigration and the wall and political correctness and all the rest. But going to that angle, this is very interesting because the other weird component of this in the election was the fact that people are pointing out 80% of white evangelicals voted for Trump, and how could they go for somebody with such a tawdry past, et cetera, et cetera. How do you make the connection between the way Trump resonated with Christians and Christians' traditional, you know, emphasis on personal morality and you know, an upstanding life and all that? How do you put that together?
It's a great question. It's very, very legitimate. I see scholars would generally argue there are two ways to analyze society in general. You can analyze it individualistically, so you focus in on the personal traits of, say, a particular person. Or you can analyze it what they call holistically. Holistically means is you're looking at the person as the representative of wider processes like demographic, economic, political, social processes. And what's so interesting here is that there's been very good scholarship over the last 10 or 20 years on the emergence of what scholars are calling the global religious right. And it really starts in the 1990s with a focus on the family and Family Research Council and Concerned Women for America, where they took their policy disputes to the United Nations and the international arena. And what they saw was they saw three sovereignties under attack by globalization. They mentioned the nation, the church, and the family as all coming under significant assault and redefinition by globalization and its secularizing processes. And so Donald Trump comes around with all of his problems, no question, but what is he promising? Well, he's promising to safeguard the nation. He's promising to protect Christians both at home and abroad. And he's promising to appoint pro-life judges. Of course, he picked Mike Pence as his VP, who has an amazingly faithful pro-life record. And the correlation between this new global religious rights concerns, which would be more holistic now, and the Trump candidacy, well, it speaks for itself. You pointed it out. 80%, over 80% of white evangelical Christians voted for him. Catholic voters voted for Trump over Clinton by a 23-point margin. These are just stunning numbers, and they're indicative of the realignment of the religious right, more around these much more holistic terms rather than the individualistic moral terms that that so many were concerned about.
That is fascinating. So in a sense, then, when you're talking about the moral climate, how much do you think that specifically played into it? Because certainly the pro-life issue, the marriage issue, the religious freedom issue, all were very important evangelicals in the last election and past the last election. And I wonder to what extent it was fueled a little bit by the fact that Hillary Clinton was so far in the other direction and just absolutely determined not only to stand over and against those things that mattered to most Christians, but also willing to put them in the basket of deplorables along the way.
Oh, my, was that not it? So, right, Obama had his clinging to guns and religion,
yeah.
And Hillary had her deplorables. And it really is. It's very enlightening in terms of how they do see this very nationalist, populist, traditionalist sentiment. I think you're absolutely right. Tony Perkins was actually interviewed right around Christmas time on PBS, on public television, and they asked him about this. You know, why is Donald Trump saying Merry Christmas so important to you Christians? Is it really that important whether or not Walmart says Merry Christmas to anyone? And Tony Perkins pointed out that the appreciation of knowing that we have an administration that is no longer hostile to our shared Christian traditions,
right,
is testimony to just how hostile Obama, for 8 years, was towards our shared Christian traditions. So, yeah, as uncanny as it may seem, this playboy TV star, thrice married real estate mogul ends up igniting an American version of this, sort of resurgent Christian traditionalism. But God's done crazier things in the past. So.
Well said. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll come back with Dr. Steve Turley. His book is President Trump and Our Post-Secular Future. Stay with us on Janet Mefford Today.
Thank you.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is John's story.
When our daughter Emma was born, my wife and I took a hard look at our finances for the first time, and we didn't like what we saw. My wife suggested that I call Trinity. Immediately when I spoke with the counselor for the first time, she was very helpful and put us on a plan for success. Right away, we knew we'd called the right place. We just want everyone out there who might be in our situation to know that there's help.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. It is so great to have with me Dr. Steve Turley. TurleyTalks.com, his website, and his new book, President Trump and Our Post-Secular Future, How the 2016 Election Signals the Dawning of a Conservative Nationalist Age. So, Dr. Turley, you're talking about this presidency of Donald Trump as being part of an emerging post-secular society. What is that all about? How do you see the emergence of a post-secular society?
Yeah, as the name implies, a post-secular society is a society that transcends, rejects secularism, or better, secularization, which is generally defined as the process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations, they lose their social significance. It's like they don't even really matter anymore. We've all felt that. We know that historically the church was like right at, you know, if you think of medieval urban planning, the church is right at the center of human life, right at the center of the city, as it were. You know, nowadays in modern urban planning, you know, we're lucky if we even see a church in, you know, next to a Pizza Hut, or, you know, it's just a completely marginalized. That's a secular society. So at its most basic level, a post-secular society refers to the return of religion and religious values and their relevance in the public square. And we're really seeing this all over the world. You and I have talked about this in the past. Shintoism in Japan, Orthodoxy in Russia, Hinduism in India, Confucianism in China, Islam in Turkey, Catholicism in Poland, Pentecostalism in South America, and the like. It's this surge of religion is moving social orders more and more away from secularized social norms and increasingly towards revitalized religious nationalist social orders. I know a lot of people feel like, oh, things are getting worse and we're getting more and more secular and the like. The numbers that are coming out are ironically the opposite. Rodney Stark's latest book, The Triumph of Faith, it showed we're going through nothing less than a mass religious renewal all over the world. It's actually, the numbers are quite stunning. And it's not to negate the ill effects that secularism has inflicted on our society that seem to be getting even worse as we speak. Yeah. But that's really only one piece of the puzzle. There's another piece, and that's this mass blowback against it that's actually getting stronger every year.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about secular globalization, you mentioned this dichotomy. On the one hand, it's more powerful than ever before, as you say, because it has right. this big global reach. But
it's also weaker than it's ever been because the modernist roots that it has have all been rotted out, basically. How so? How is that the case?
Oh, yeah, that's great. And that's so key, I think, to understanding the times we're living in. So on what we have to understand is that globalization is rooted in modernity. And modernity is this notion that scientific rationalism is the sole objective way of knowing the world. And we had three experiments in the 20th century of which vision of scientific rationalism was going to rule the world. We had secular liberal democracy, we had communism, and we had Nazism. They all tried a different experience. So secular liberal democracy said that, obviously, secular liberal democracy is the one political system that's going to rule the world. Communism said that Marxism is the one economic system that's going to rule the world, and Nazism said that fascism is going to be the one racial cultural system to rule the world. And what's interesting here is that two out of three are now more or less dead, with secular liberal democracy reigning through, well, previously through the Obama administration, through the UN, through the EU, through the big global trade organizations alike. But the problem is that we talk about this thing called postmodernism. Your average Joe on the streets or your average George in Europe, as it were, they don't believe in this one-size-fits-all objective scientific rationalism is the only true way of running the world. And so what's happened is that the foundational root for globalization, modernity, has basically died. We've gone to post-modernity where we don't even believe in truth anymore.
Right.
And what has happened now is that that has developed into sort of reawakened fidelities to culture and to language and to ethnicity and to land and nationality and tradition and the like. So on one sense, what we're seeing is we're seeing the roots of globalization having died, even although the fruits are still there. Globalization is still being exported throughout the world via the West. But now there is this mass blowback because nobody buys into the roots anymore. And that really is the ace in the hole. Democrats can think they can take the House. They think they can bring in a whole, Oprah can save us. They think they can bring in this whole new age of globalization, secularism. Unfortunately for them, they don't realize the very philosophical modernist foundation for that is basically dead. Postmodernism has replaced it, and it's moving now to nation, culture, and tradition.
Boy, that is so interesting. There's so many things we could go off and discuss just based on what you've said. But for time's sake, one of the things that pops into my head as I'm looking at your book and I'm looking at what your premises are and all of your arguments here, which I think are great. One of the things that I wonder about, though, is despite the fact that you had Trump win based on the wall and based on, no more political correctness and I'm going to get the economy going again and all the rest, the pro-life issue has been great for him. And we just recently had the March for Life, and President Trump was the first U.S. sitting president to show up and address the marchers, which was huge. But on the LGBT agenda, we're not getting much. I mean, and so this is interesting. Do you see the three-legged stool of Reagan sort of going away in politics, that even as we return to conservatism, perhaps under Trump, economically, maybe socially speaking a little bit, but not so much that it would be a prime factor in the GOP? I'm just wondering how you put all those pieces together. What will that look like?
Yeah, it is. It's a tough one in terms of how it's sorting itself out. So just to give you the idea where scholars are with this, they would, instead of saying globalism versus nationalism, they would say many societies are redefined as globalism versus localism. They mean the same thing, but they use localism instead to capture these traditionalist sentiments. But because of the mess that we're in, they've actually coined a phrase where secularism and traditionalism are mixed, and they call it, if you can believe it, glocalism.
Oh, that's funny.
And that's how I would interpret the whole, homosexual LGBT stuff with Trump. he's right on the money when it comes to the pro-life issue. Man, has this been great stuff. And he's been on the money in terms of protecting religious liberties,
yes.
Little Sisters of the Poor,
yes.
All that great stuff. He's been there. But then you've got this glocalism where, and I think did I read correctly, he congratulated, the Log Cabin Republicans
yes.
on their 40th anniversary. And,
yes.
You know, nonsense like that.
Right.
So, yeah, that's going to be kind of the glocal kind of contradictions that are in there in this dialectic. And in terms of, like, Reagan was so clean. Reagan was so clear. It was so logical in terms of his conservatism. Whereas now with this postmodern sort of middle ground, yeah, you're going to see a lot of inconsistencies there. I think cultures work themselves out, though. So, for example, individuals are very, very inconsistent, but cultures tend to be consistent.
Hmm.
So individual atheists can be very, very ethical, virtuous people, but atheist cultures are holes.
Yeah, right, right. Yes.
So the question is really, in the end, if modernity has truly died, and if we really are therefore moving into a time of nation, culture, tradition, then I think the days not only of abortion are limited, but including with it LGBT rights.
Oh, I hope you're right. I hope
yeah.
you're right. I think that that's great news. And of course, we don't know for sure what's coming down the pike, but it's interesting to watch those trends. And you've got such great insight, I would say, on what's been going on, not only in terms of politics, but also in terms of history and some of these movements and philosophical movements that you've studied. And it's such a fascinating read. You really need to pick it up. President Trump and Our Post-Secular Future, How the 2016 Election Signals the Dawning of a Conservative Nationalist Age. TurleyTalks.com is his website. And as always, Dr. Turley, just a joy to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Janet. God bless you.
You too. Thanks for being with us. And thank you for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.